Okay, there's going to be a really quick handover where we introduce the final session, a panel. If I can ask Jen and Roger and Johnny and Spencer to come up and talk about record labels and reissues and lost records and such. Hello, one, two. Yeah, okay, this is the Motley Crue. I put this event today together and I run a small record label that deals often in reissues and trying to dig out obscurities that don't even exist on YouTube, and I do that with a colleague of mine, and we've been going a few years. So I thought it'd be nice to speak to three chaps with similar enterprises, much more esteemed than mine. And to bring it all together, I've asked Jen, Alan from The Wire to kind of stop them talking when they need to be stopped, I suppose. So yeah, the final session of the day, over to you. I think you're on, Jen.
I'm on. Okay, so hello everyone, thanks for coming. So yeah, we're at the final panel here, and I'm Jennifer Allen from The Wire, the online editor. And at the end, we've got Roger Armstrong, co-founder of Ace Records. And then we've got Johnny Trunk of Trunk Records, and Spence Hickman of Death Waltz. So I want to, rather than sum it up for you, I'd really like to start by getting you all to sum up in a line or two what your label is about and your sort of primary interests, as it were.
Ace Records, we started out life as Chiswick Records pre-punk and recorded various pre-punk and punk rock acts. Had a sort of commercial mainstream pop label up to early 80s. Then it all became about men in funny haircuts with strange trousers playing ironing boards. So very un-rock and roll. And we got out, back to rock and roll. We always had a catalogue operation. And I started a world music label with Ben Mandelson up there in the 80s and wandered around the world pointing microphones at unsuspecting people. And finally, we're now really a hardcore catalogue, deep catalogue operation, licensing and buying catalogue and sort of mixing it up and turning it out as in fact, mainly CDs. We're still, I think we'll be the last people standing selling CDs or selling physical carriers to the world, basically. We do tend to deal with a slightly, let's say, more mature audience who still like to have their objects. They still like to have what I describe we do is stack them low, sell them high. We ain't cheap and we don't have to sell a lot that way. And we can maintain the quality through that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where we've landed now.
Johnny?
I started Trunk Records in 1995 because as a film music collector, realised I couldn't get the records I wanted, so I realised I had to make them myself. So it's quite a selfish label in that the records I put out are records I want to hear. And it's as simple as that, really. I'm just a one-man operation. And I put out about five or six records a year. That's about it, really.
Mm-hmm. And that's included, as well as film music, that's included sort of TV soundtracks.
Film music, library music, unreleased, odd stuff, buffet car announcements, yeah. You know, sort of. anything that sort of I think's worthy of being heard by a slightly smaller, slightly bigger audience. Yeah.
Got it right
first. Yeah, did.
We deal with small audiences, yeah, and universal, yeah, to the big ones.
Spencer, your label is a lot younger. You only started in 2011.
Yeah.
About.
Yeah.
And yours is a quite a concentrated.
It is. I mean, kind of our tagline is the art of soundtracks because I always wanted to do new artwork, and I'm a big horror video nasties fan. So that's kind of what I wanted to release. Like weird Italian crap films that have got great soundtracks. And it's kind of grown.
But not such good artwork.
No, but with like really amazing artwork. So, and it's kind of, yeah, it just grew really quickly. I mean, like phenomenally quickly. And I used to run Rough Trade East and had to leave because I couldn't do both. And now we're just ready in Twin Peaks working with David Lynch. It's kind of weird. We've just been talking about it outside, like how big it's got really quickly. It's quite bewildering and worrying, but, you know. The same as Johnny. I just want to release stuff that I want to listen to. Like, I just signed this really terrible zombie cannibal film from, like, 1981 in Italy that no one in the world wants to put this record out. I've got 30 cues, 20 of them have never, ever been released, and I'm so excited. It's going to be a double. I'll lose money on it. Or I might break even if we're lucky. But I'm like, I listened to it. I got the masters this week, and I listen to it like obsessively all day. So I'm a fan that's stupid.
I want to sort of talk about the formats on which you all release on, because as probably say to make a generalisation, Johnny and Spencer, you're very vinyl centric. Johnny, you're quite vinyl centric, and Roger, you said you're still focused on CD.
Mainly CD, yes, but I mean vinyl's having a renaissance at the moment.
And is that something that Ace is?
I think it's
picking up on.
I don't know. I think it exists on two levels. It exists on the kind of high-end, heavyweight vinyl, you know, cut off the original analog master tape, that kind of end of the marketplace, selling at £40 a pop, right down to, kind of, to be honest, the fashion item. I mean, I grew up in the 60s, and, you know, when you bought a new album, I remember getting the import of Captain Beefheart's Trout Mask replica and walking around Belfast with it, you know, so it's like, you know, nice new shirt. Nice, you know, nice pair of shoes and Captain Beefheart's album. Yeah. There's because of the lot. I mean, it is sort of that people always said that when it went to CD, that you know, the cover A for designers, it wasn't as nice a landscape to design on, a good landscape. And so I think it is that. And I've heard sort of anecdotally from friends of mine who've got kids and grandkids, who say that they will buy the vinyl album, you get the free download, and they'll put the album on the wall. They don't even have a record player. I mean, it's a picture to them. It's an artifact to them. So I think there's that end of the market, and in between people who just still quite like the sound of vinyl. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, I'd say most of the vinyls coming out nowadays are actually cut from the digital tapes. It makes a bit of a nonsense of the sort of warm sound of analog that people feel. A good mastering studio will master the digital tape that cuts the vinyl with it in mind that it's going onto vinyl. Because that's what I was just discussing with one of my engineers the other day, just as an aside, and he said that one of the reasons early CDs sounded really bad was that the record companies grabbed the EQ master that cut the vinyl, mm-hmm. which was usually hyped on the top end, because in the vinyl process you lost top end, so you hyped it in the top end and it hit the vinyl at a good level, and a good cutting engineer knew how to do that. You pulled that off and put it in a CD and it shrieked at you, which mm-hmm. was why a lot of early CDs didn't sound very good, actually. And it wasn't until later that people realised that you had to really go back to the original analogues and master for CD, because mastering for CD is a different thing to mastering for analogue.
Mm. And how often are you all able to actually go back to those analogue tapes?
Last week.
Frequently.
Yesterday.
But in terms of,
you know, quite often.
Yeah,
it's very. I think it's very difficult these days, and probably very expensive to cut from a master directly onto, you know, to vinyl in that sort of audiophile fashion. And it's very few companies that do it. But the trouble is, at the moment, there's loads of companies with big stickers going audiophile vinyl, and it's quite clearly not. Mm. It's just a CD master. Given to a pressing plant who then cut normally off it, but they're selling premium product based on. Mm. I had a big.
They're selling an idea.
Yeah,
So the process has changed so that there's this kind of this mastering process on top of mastering process, which then that is not actually reversed, or you don't take the step back to then put it back on vinyl.
It's very difficult to get these days. It's very expensive to get a master tape and cut directly from that.
I mean, there's a move. John Dent up in Wales, I spoke to him at WOMAD, and he's cutting direct from 96 24 WAVs to vinyl and saying he's getting a very good result. I mean, he's getting close to what you would get cutting off
we've just done one of our fours coming.
Yeah, and that's kind of a sort of, that's a pretty decent ground to be in that sense, you know. Sam, by talking about getting off the master tape last week, well, I pulled the audio off 16-inch acetates in the last couple of weeks because we own these catalogues. We own a catalogue for Europe called Modern Records, and they go back to 1945, and everything for the first 5 years of the catalogue was cut to 16-inch acetate, which was, in fact, a fantastic medium. I mean, they sound amazing. In fact, they sound much better than early tapes around that period, to be honest, you know, because tape technology took a while to settle and people took a while to learn how to use it. And so that early tapes, actually, sometimes you'll find they cut a tape and an acetate, and the acetate's invariably better, you know. And they sound great, and we have a special custom-built deck.
I was going to say, how are you going to... Yeah, where's the equipment?
Pink triangle deck, custom-made, the okay, large right. platter and a huge arm. It's an amazing looking thing. Right. If I'm trying to get Arthur over there to do me a funk deck, his new one, at a full 16-inch platter.
On the other extreme, you've got companies like ERC, the Electric Recording Company, who's the guy from Peace Fog, who's obsessive about valve-driven systems.
And that is a... just that.
He's got the only one in the world, yeah. He's got the only stereo and mono purely valve cutting lay tape transfer to lathe setup, which is made by Autophon Lyrec.
And he's concerned with a sort of very high-end classical.
Super high-end.
Which is collector level.
His records are £300 each, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the records he's releasing are thousands and thousands of pounds.
Tens of thousands of pounds, yeah. But he does it in that purely, I mean, you go in the studio and it's extraordinary. The sound is not like anything else. And it's this audio, you know, it's audio perfection, really. Taking, you know, perfect recordings of you know, groundbreaking classical pieces and reproducing them as they were reproduced in the 50s on the highest equipment you can.
There's a sort of sympathy through the system that you could say that's good. But ultimately, as one of my engineers, I've always liked his quote about in the argument between digital and analog being one better than the other, and he just said, it depends what kind of distortion you prefer.
Yeah, it depends what you're playing on, ultimately, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you have to think, with the resurgence of like vinyl in the last 5-7 years, companies like Crossley make those really cheap turntables that they're like briefcases, and they sound well. And it sounds great.
There's such a small percentage of people who buy records who actually care.
Yeah. Really. I'd like to sit here and say everything we release is from the original master tape.
But it's 90%
of it is, but some of it isn't. So I wanted to release Forbidden World, which is this super low budget 1982 Roger Corman film, and it's a terrible rip-off of Alien. It's one of my favourite films from when I was a kid. I was like 13, was obsessed with it. The synth, it's like a really cheesy synth new wave score. I contacted Susan Justin, the composer. She went into a garage and she was like, I've got a cassette of it, like an actual C90 cassette. She said that I recorded off the vinyl copy that we released. But in the end, we mastered it from the original. We found an unopened copy of the vinyl. I spent £2,000 making it sound as good as it possibly could, and put something on the sleeve saying, this isn't mastered from the original master tape. It's taken from what it is. But because I wanted to,
re-releasing that and creating the access to that again is more important than
press. It was on web, you know. They did like 4 soundtracks, and they only did like 300 or something.
Can I ask also, like we're talking about digital as well, what your approaches are to releasing your or reissuing for digital? Because often
I filled out a metadata form last week. you guys really like metadata.
Love it. Right? It's my favourite. Yeah.
I had a lesson in how to do it. My distribution company, Republic of Music, they were like, you've got to be on iTunes, and you've got to be on Spotify, and we're on there. I think I've earned about £2 or something in the last 8 months or something. I mean, the stuff that we do. People who buy digital are not that interested, you know, like Miss 45 soundtrack. No one is going to go on, well, 2 people have gone on iTunes and purchased that. But, you know, which has paid for itself.
The thing I think we've got in common in a sense is that we're not just selling music, we're selling music and information. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I say, and I'm only half joking, say what we do is we sell booklets and we throw some free music in with it. Mm. I mean, because that's so important. I mean, any fool can go out and download the music, and that's kind of out there now. And granted, the quality's not as good, you know. I mean, I personally find most regular MP3s unlistenable. But, you know, so the quality of the music on the CD is better. But really, the other thing, huge thing that's missing is the information that comes with it, you know? And because we employ, we've got 5 freelance guys who are experts in their own area. They do their research. They often go and do first-hand research interviewing people. So what's in our booklets is sort of absolutely new.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, nobody's ever heard this stuff before or written about this stuff before. And, you know, certainly people that buy our CDs, I think, are buying it as much for... And the number of people say, it's great, sit down with the book, put the CD on, that's the whole experience, you know. It's not just the music's over there somewhere.
It's not a we. You feel an idiot saying I, don't you?
No, you get used to it, it's fine. No.
we get like a lot of feedback from people who really love all the liner notes. Like from the artists, because they like to know whatever that process is, and then the composers and the directors. So for me, it is really, that is the huge. It's totally about listening to the music, but it's also about the whole package. I can't believe I should charge like £30 for our records because they're phenomenally expensive.
But all three. Like labels do have very extensive sleeve notes, and you're often piecing together the stories of what happened with that artist, what happened with that label. There's often even a personal story to do with how you got hold of that person, and how, like, I remember reading maybe a blog post or something about Johnny, you ending up in like Oliver Postgate's basement or something like this.
His underworld, yes.
Yeah. And then, but those stories are kind of almost, they're almost like. The metadata is very important, but those stories and things are things that you can't really replicate in a digital way. It's very hard.
I've never had anyone email me and go, I love the digital booklet with blah, blah, blah.
And do you do PDFs?
No, I did two, and then I just ran out. I just couldn't be bothered. I just think it's a different market. I just think it's a completely different market. I really do.
One of the things you notice about, like, sort of iTunes and all these download things, the one thing they won't let you do is leave their site. I mean, ideally, we're starting to develop digital downloads directly from our own website, and one of the things I want to develop is not just a PDF, but a downloadable version of the sleeve note with links. So, you know, there'll be a link, you read about something, and it'll send, you can link through and send you off our website for a while to get some more information on an artist or on something or other. And, you know, where we'll sort of only link you to something we think is good, so to speak. And it's always struck me as being a shame, because that's the whole point about publishing on the web, is that whole notion that you can fire off into all sorts of different corners of it and find out, in a sense, create your own sleeve note out of the basic one by where you choose to go. And yet, you know, that's one thing that, you know, iTunes, yes, you can have a PDF, but you're not allowed to click off and leave it. And that's this thing about that great book, which is Digital Medieval, and talks about creating this sort of whole internet of individual city-states, and you can't leave any of them, you know. You can leave them, but you have to really leave them and then go and join another one. You can't go from one directly to the other, which sort of...
We started offering... We do a subscription package, 300 people, where you pay £200 for 6 releases, you get an exclusive colourway. Then we give you loads of free stuff, which costs us far more than we charge for subscription. It's like the worst business model ever. Don't ever do. But they started to moan because... So we've offered them... People were moaning that we weren't giving them free digital downloads. Mm-hmm. And I was saying to them, I only have to type in the film and media fire or whatever it is after it, and there's like 100 blogs that you can just go and steal that for free.
Or it's on YouTube.
Yeah, it's really odd. And then look, we said, all right, we'll give you, if you buy it direct from us, we'll give you a free download. And everyone's like, oh, that's the best thing ever. It's just like, wow, it's kind of weird. Because, I mean, I steal loads of music. Gets us to listen to.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's peculiar. The digital thing is odd. It's kind of not really something. I've got a ton of music on my phone for when I'm sort of traveling, but not overly interested in it. And I think the people that buy at like our releases, all three of us, they're not either really. Mm-hmm. You know, they want, especially with vinyl. You want. I remember when I was a kid, and this is nostalgia, but it's stayed with me for my whole life. Is getting the Muppet Show album and listening to it and looking at all the pictures and the gatefold and stuff like that. I think it is, isn't it? Like it's an experience.
But you can't. I mean, the internet has the potential to be great in terms of delivering music, and as sort of broadband gets broader or whatever, and you can deliver larger files. I mean, that's my gripe about it. Mostly, it's pretty awful sounding. But, you know, once that's the whole area that really needs developing, and it could actually, once you'd have notes, you'd have your metadata, and you have a lot of information that you could provide in one place, so to speak.
Sort of easily accessible package.
That's right. That's kind of got a...
Yeah, it's still going to be a bit crap, isn't it?
I mean, I know what we do is really niche and is going to become, you know...
No, I just think that the internet's its problem is about its potential. It's got potential in terms of developing into something more
idiots,
broadly
though.
Interesting. What?
It's full of idiots.
Right. This
you can say that about. Yeah. One can say that about a lot of things.
Yeah, but I can go home. I'm at home, and my internet is full of idiots.
But I mean, what you're saying is, Roger, you have faith that there will come a time in which all these stories and the sleeve notes and the extended things you have will be, you'll be able to package them online and release them, whereas Johnny and Spencer get the impression you don't believe that is possible.
I just don't
really
think he would be the same.
Same experience, isn't it?
No, it's
but
not.
Is that because
you've
grown up with like paper and records?
Know. And there are people out there, as my good friend Ben will tell you, the cassette's the best thing to have, you know. I mean, again, it's back to different strokes for different folks,
yeah.
You know. Quite honestly, you know, I mean, I have a vast collection of scratchy vinyl 45s that I adore and think sound absolutely wonderful, you know. And notwithstanding, I'll still go on my big hi-fi and play music on it, you know. I don't say one, because of one thing, I can't do the other, you know. Mm.
I think if someone could come up with a PDF file being interesting online, they're going to make a lot of money. If you can do that, then...
No, it's a file that where you can link. So in other words, you've got your movie soundtrack, you know, people are reading about it, about the movie, and there's a certain actor in the movie, and you can click on that and find out what else that actor
did.
But
I can kind of do that. I can do that on my own anyway.
Yeah, no, but you're obsessive and you're looking to research it.
I'm not obsessive. And
I'm
normal.
You know, but you're selling to people that don't have the time to do the research, etc. I mean, that's, of course, why people buy our records and people buy my stuff because of the notes, etc., because they don't have the time.
I would argue they do have the time because they sit down with that record, listen to it, and pour over the notes and look at the sleeve, and then they go off in their own time and do go to IMDb or blogs.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
if you want to find the information,
if you've got an appetite for it, I think you will go and do it. I personally,
you're looking at making ridiculous that vision you have would be to spend, lots of time creating these beautiful and interesting and integrated, booklets online that would take ages to make, and probably 1% of the people buying it would actually take any notice.
I'm looking at that in terms of, how to move sort of online sales forward certainly for a catalogue company like myself. I mean, ours are reasonably good, our online sales, but I mean, it's not a business. But it's I can sort of see that it could become a broader thing. I mean, if I'm going to spend a fortune doing that and making that available, I'm going to charge for it.
Can you see it going
the
other way?
That's the truth of the matter.
Can you see it going the other way?
What?
Your digital business getting slightly
no.
Okay.
No, growing regularly. Yeah, absolutely. Partly. I mean, again, we've developed the website, so we're looking for the download thing to sort of attract more traffic. You know, by doing special things and setting up sort of areas which are. I'm setting up a thing at the moment called the Singles Bar, where you can come and buy a download single, you'll get a shot of the original label, and in some cases you can actually buy the vinyl. We'll create vinyl for that, so you can buy them both or either or whatever.
I want to also talk about, because I'm aware that we haven't actually got that much time, even though we could probably sit here all night.
I could bore you senseless.
But there's one really crucial thing that has happened in... really recently with licensing and reissues and stuff, which was Cliff's Law, which...
Cliff's Law?
Cliff's Law, isn't it? Yeah. So that the sort of extension of copyright from on... and that is on performance, from 50 to 70 years.
Yeah. 75, I think.
To 75?
Is it 75? I think 75.
This is your...
Was it 70 or 75? 20.
So, but this affects a lot of... This means that it's called Cliff's Law, if in case anyone doesn't know, because it means that now the dinosaur that is Cliff Richard is able to keep hold of all the all his royalties and things like that.
It's Beatles.
Oh yeah, and it's Maggie's Law as well. Yeah, but it's been tagged Cliff's Law.
No one cares about Cliff. It's all about Mac.
Yeah, that's true. But was that a big deal for any of you? It was passed in 2011. Was that a big deal for you, or has it affected any of your plans? Or
there was a poison chalice right in the middle of it, because some bright spark at the EU wrote in that there should be a 20% levy for a session fund on income from all recordings benefiting from the extension.
So in sort of layman's terms,
well, it means that in my business, if I was to suck in a 20% of income on sales of a record into the bottom line, I lose money on every record, full stop. To put it in layman's terms, I should have looked it up who she was. Somebody here might know. The woman who played harp on She's Leaving Home by the Beatles, when that finally gets the benefit from the copyright law, she will earn way more than all four Beatles put together.
Okay.
For going deedly deedly. It's complete absurdity. I mean, the basic argument in many ways for the law was, as artists, particularly and session people, the whole idea was that this should go through PPL. Mm-hmm. If they were really going to put some kind of levy in for session people, it should have been at PPL level. And the Musicians Union, everybody wants it to be at that level. Instead of this absurd retail level suddenly being introduced. And the idea was quite good, because it was that, there are more and more people who are reaching late in life, and suddenly their income stream stops because things go out of copyright.
But do you think
they're older, so they're not able to generate income the same way as they were. And so that was really what the moving force behind the whole thing was in the first place. Plus to bring it into line with the copyright laws, involving the mechanicals, because, why should the person that wrote the song sort of get any better deal than the person that sings the song, so to speak,
Because, mechanicals, like publishing, sort of that covers, composition, everything, and that is that lifetime plus 70 years?
It's actually 70 years from the death of the last writer, which is why at one stage a lot of three-year-olds were writing songs.
And Johnny, did that affect? I mean,
no, so it did annoy me a bit because there were so many records issued by major labels that I couldn't license through major labels because I just can't get involved. They just, no matter how hard I try, I can't license from major labels. They either put their prices way too high, or they don't.
And they never get back to me.
And they don't want to. They either want to release themselves, or they don't.
Use it or lose it clause. The problem is, again, and this is the problem about governments writing law, they should not be allowed near it, is that it's completely unmanageable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a shame. I mean, that's not the record company's fault or anybody else's fault. That is some twat at the government writing bad law. All of the people involved in the recording would have to claim it back. I mean, it's absurd, It's a reversion to the artists. In some cases, if there was a record you wanted to put out and you did know everybody that was involved in it, you could get all of them together and you could get them to claim it back. And therefore cut a deal with them directly. I mean, that is...
But they've got to claim it back. And a lot of these
they have to claim it back from the majors. Yeah.
And then you've got to find the right...
But there are examples. The famous Ronnie Carroll comes from my part of the world as a rather anodyne singer of the 50s, did it once. He went to whoever it was, owned his rights, Columbia, and said, you're not putting it out, I want it back. And he pestered them so much. They said, oh, have it. And he ended up controlling his own rights. And sometimes you can do it. I mean, if you sort of be honest, if you get out there and challenge the record company's, paperwork. Paperwork on back there is sometimes a bit thin.
Yeah.
And if they're not going to do it, et cetera, I got some recordings back from EMI many years back, but it took us 2 years to persuade them that, they didn't have the rights, and they eventually said, oh, okay, we don't.
2 years,
Actually, to what I think we is worth touching on is that you all... your labels are very professional operations. You put out releases regularly, but actually, they are. But actually, what goes on behind the scenes is a lot of wrangling, a lot of faffing about. So, could you sort of give a brief? Each of you give a brief sort of scenario of your either your favourite or your average situation and how long something takes and what that involves?
It's taken me 3 years to get Twin Peaks through Warners. It's taken me 37 different cover designs to be approved by David Lynch, which is amazing. I want to do an art show when we launch it, saying not approved. But which is awesome, but you know, I mean, it's great for me because I'm a fan, so I get to work directly with him and show him all this stuff, and he's like, that's awful. He sent me a list saying, this is horrific, this is okay, these two I really like. So that's taken three, like literally, like my, yeah, I mean, it's before I even released anything we started. So that's taken 3 years, but then something else you can get licensed in two days or
yeah,
you know one Skype call
yeah,
or something.
One email.
It's just such an odd. There's no right way. Everything's different.
And
some things are great and some things are a nightmare.
Depends what you're going out there with. So we did a series based around the Dylan's Theme Time Radio Hour, and did three double CDs in conjunction with Jeff Rosen, Bob Dylan's manager. And it's amazing people like White Stripes. That cleared in 24 hours. They don't license for compilation, but Bob Dylan's name was in the front of it. It's cleared in 24 hours. At the other end of the scale, there's a label called Fame Records out of Muscle Shoals. If anybody hasn't seen the Muscle Shoals movie, go see it, it's great. And Rick Hall, who is the main studio owner in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, the Fame Studios, from starting, first meeting Rick, to actually cutting a deal was just shy of 20 years. And I spoke to him on the phone the other day, and he said, wow, it's fantastic what you guys have been doing in my catalogue. It's like, yeah. Thanks, Rick.
Johnny?
And for me, it's the same as Spencer, you know, 3 years to 3 minutes. It really depends on... It's a lot easier these days because you've got the internet, and you can normally... It's probably why there's such a proliferation of new labels, is because you go, what do I like to do that? Google. Oh, there's the owner. Ooh, email. Ooh.
I always start with a composer if they're alive.
Yeah.
Not their families if they're dead.
But it's
are you often doing a lot of detective work to try and find out what happened to somebody? I mean,
there's loads of that. That's
you?
Kind of what I like. It's kind of in a funny way.
That's half the
adventure really is the detective work. But it is you have to. If it's not working online, that's where it starts getting really interesting. You have to start being quite, ooh, and I kind of get quite a big thrill out of tracking down things in the old-fashioned ways, you know, using the phone and writing a letter. So still do that, sending a fax.
Could you give us an example of a time when that's happened?
Oh, God, let me think. No, I do quite a lot of, I had some interesting things with Mike Sams, who was in hospital when I... Got hold of him, but you know, he was dying basically by the time I'd started to talk to him, and then he died, and I spent his neighbour was got me around his house the day before it was cleared by all these house clearers. So I found myself in the middle of this weird house which had been wrecked by house clearers, with anything of any value removed from this building where the bloke had you know died a couple of days before, and then. In one room was all his master tapes and all his personal, very sort of charming personal possessions, which were obviously worthless to the house clearers, but of some value to me and his sort of... And his family didn't want it. It was the most extraordinary place to be in this sort of post-house clearance, post-death, sad place with the neighbour going, take everything, otherwise it's going to skip, take everything. And it was just, it's just an interesting place to be, I suppose, in this man's old... You know, in amongst all these belongings that hadn't been looked at, loved, or listened to for probably 40 years. And there they were, ready to go in the skip. Masses of stuff. It was mad.
It's one of the advantages of being, what I would call, to be honest, the more legit end, not doing out of copyright. We pay royalties on material that's technically out of copyright. And one of the advantages of that is you get to meet the people. I mean, that's it. You can approach them. These out of copyright guys, they don't go near. Owner, record company owners or artists or whatever, so they won't get that information. They won't be able to sort of make what their piece, their work, full, because they can't get to the first-hand information. You
that's
know?
That's my favourite bit, talking to the director or the composer. Or if they're all dead, it's kind of a little bit boring.
Yeah. It's definitely better when they're alive.
If they're dead, you can do it, but there's kind of no fun in it. It's a bit joyless, because that's the amazing thing. Like, you know, like Fabio Frizzi, I struck up like an amazing friendship with him over the last couple of years, and we've got 3 records in the pipeline this year, and it's amazing. Mm. Like, that to me is what I really love, and, you know, it's that personal connection and stuff. And, you know, I much prefer that. I love it when you get, like, I spoke to a composer this week, quite a famous Italian composer, and asked him for sleeve notes for this, quite frankly, terrible, shockingly bad movie. And he was like, I know, I don't remember doing that. I was like, really? You did 30 cues for it? 90 minutes of music? He's like, no, I can't talk about that. And he's like really embarrassed by it. And I'm like, but it's awesome. Like, it's a fucking sounds brilliant. Sorry, I didn't think I know I'll persuade him, but it's going to take a little bit of time.
Yeah, how often do you also sort of find the people that you want to release or, you know, that they're surprised that anyone wants to hear this music again or wants it to be rediscovered?
Yeah, most of them. Because a lot of the time it wasn't even taken any notice of when it came out. So if it's had no interest in 40 years, why would it have interest now? Mm. But make sure you tell them there's only going to be a little bit of interest.
You want to keep those licensing fees low.
Yeah. Well, you have to, you know. They are only little blips, aren't they? Very rarely does anything sort of, you know, go off the scale, like, say, the, you know, Vashti Bunyan record or whatever, you know, which was he did 1,000 copies and ended up selling 150,000 in the end, you know, for a record that had sold 200-300 copies in the day, and she was, you know, it's extraordinary. There's very few like that. It's what lots of little labels would like, because obviously it makes you, gives you a lot more flexibility in the sort of years ahead, I think. But
And even with the resurgence in vinyl sales, which obviously everyone talks about, you're still not, you know.
The resurgence in the resurgence in vinyl is almost like a
comedy.
It's, yeah, well, it's kind of distorted in how much people talk about it. You know, for example, like a
because it's the only physical. It's the only great part of the physical industry, so everyone is excited.
Yeah.
About it, but it's such a small tiny.
Well, yeah, Craig Leon's Nomos, which has recently been reissued, a few thousand copies now, which is loads. Whereas he said back then that was released in 1982, and it was a complete flop and sold about 30,000 to 50,000.
Yeah.
So I mean, still the numbers are completely distorted, and this vinyl resurgence is a resurgence of sorts, but it's not a return to previous figures.
And sometimes that's a problem because if people who put records out 30 years ago know those kinds of numbers, I'll tell you what, if I could sell that, I wouldn't be sat here.
No,
I'd be being sat in France right now. But you know, and that can be really difficult because I'm talking to someone, the producers of Silent Night, Deadly Night, which was this Christmas slasher film from '74.
Sounds lovely, friends.
Yeah, and there was uproar about it, and everything was destroyed, and they've just found the tapes. But those guys think we're going to sell. You know, are we going to sell 30,000 copies on vinyl? And I'm like, I'd probably knock a few noughts off that.
One of the worst we had was an artist's daughter told her that we were ripping her off because she'd looked on Amazon and she'd sold 287,716 records. She was the 287,716th top-selling artist in Amazon that week.
It does say number, Dexter, doesn't it?
So there is that managing of expectations, and you know, I'm sure that we're all the same. I work on super small margins.
And is that something that Ace has always worked on, though? So Ace has always worked on those sort of smaller margins, and maybe so have you. Then sort of insulated yourself almost then for the way a new label like Spencer's would operate now.
I don't know how they operate. But
I don't know.
You don't know.
I've worked in. I've worked in record shops since I was 14. I'm 44. I never run a label. I put records out back in '96 and sold 3 copies on tour or whatever, but I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just doing it. And at the end of every month, I hope I can pay my bills and I can pay every person that tries to take money from you releasing a record and keep going.
It's the long tail, sort of, as it's called, is the key to it, you know? I mean, we're carrying about, 1,500 records at the moment in catalogue. Mm. We've got records that sell one or two a month, but if you've got 200 records selling one or two a month, you know, and they've paid their way, they've got their origination back, and so you're in profit in each one of them. I mean, distribution-wise, we've got layers of it right down to some people in small record stores and whatever. Peterborough will ring us up and he'll put his credit card on ordering two CDs and we'll put it in a jiffy bag and send it to him. I mean, you're distributing down to that level these days at the same way as you've got sort of more, a lot of export distribution around Europe and America, Japan, etc. But, you know, I mean, you really have to make every sale count. And the other thing is the advantage we have over the majors is that if you order a record from us, chances are you'll get it. It'll be in stock. And so therefore you become out there in the retail and distribution trade. They get to trust you, you know. So I always think it's a big sort of thing in terms of maintaining your sales is to always be able to make the record available. Mm. I mean, we do delete when we get down to so much, but quite often, I mean, we're not really deleting, we put them out to grass for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And you sort of, it's funny, you can be selling two a month and you finally run out of pressings and you leave it for 2 to 3 years, you put it out and you sell 400 copies and then you go back to selling two a month. But at least you've sold the 400 copies and you've covered yourself for the next pressing, you know. I mean, some of the things we've had kicking. We've got a Link Ray record we've had in catalogue since, what is it, 1978. It started in vinyl, it's in CD, it's still going. Same cover.
Okay, so and where we're running over a bit, but we've just got time for a very few short questions, I think. Yeah. So there's a mic knocking around if anyone has any questions for... Two mics.
I've covered everything.
No questions because everyone wants to go to the pub.
That's it. Oh, we've got one.
One?
One.
Just views on Neil Young's new player?
Pono.
What, the Pono?
Pono.
Any views don't on? Even start. Whoever, he's so out of touch. Whoever has said to him, a triangular MP3 player, it's going to really fit in my pocket. It's really portable.
It's not an MP3
no,
player.
No, the man is insane. I can't discuss it, sorry. I've done a Facebook rant this week already.
Take that as a no, then.
It's this big, and it's triangular.
And it holds... And it's 1,900 kilobytes a second FLAC files. No, the ultrasonics... The problem with... I mean, I can weigh in here because I've been reading about it for The Wire. The problem with Pono is, like, the... Well, if you watch that video, he asks loads of deaf musicians who've been playing, presumably without earplugs, for about 20 years, what they think of this, like, really high-end audio file, which is, you know, they're flawed kind of subjects, you know. But apparently, I was reading a lot about it on sort of audio sites, the files are such high resolution that that is outside of our hearing range. And also, files that are that high resolution have, I think it's like ultrasonics, which when you play them back will interfere. So having something that high resolution will actually sound worse than something lower resolution because there's frequencies in there that interfere with each other and make it sound bad. So aside from the fact that it looks like a Toblerone, like sonically,
sonically you're going to listen to it on Beats headphones. Great.
Yeah.
The headphones cost £1,000.
That was that whole thing with remastered for iTunes, mastered for iTunes, where the albums are 15, 16 quid, and but they're remastered higher than DVD quality, and they're just...
But what you were saying before, like those files have not been, treated properly. That is a branding exercise for iTunes and a marketing exercise, rather than taking those files and actually improving on them for a digital format. Like you're saying, mastering for CD, mastering for vinyl. Mastering for digital is another thing altogether.
It strikes me, there's a level at which it becomes a little bit pointless. Well, it depends on the music you're actually putting on it. Mm. I mean, you know, if you get a lot of 50s music, to be honest, the dynamic range is such that 8-bit would be perfectly adequate. You know, that's the reality of it, you know. So, I mean, yeah, it's fine, you know. So
Pono would make me want to go to the toilet.
Okay.
The
frequencies. You know, Pono is secretly just the brown note. It's Neil Young's brown note.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't interest me. I listen to all kinds of crappy files. I listen to it on the go.
We kind of really mastered the highest quality we can, but we're realistic about it. A guy wrote to one of my engineers and said, I love your mastering, and I got 50 grand to spend on a hi-fi. Could you recommend some stuff for me? And Nick wrote back to him and said, spend 5 grand on the hi-fi and 45 on your room. It gets to that point where, like, to be honest, you know, the environment you're listening to is having way more of an interference on what you're hearing than anything to do with the resolution of the audio in the first place.
You know? Like you mentioned before about 50s recordings, this is all, we can talk in general terms about this, but actually it's a case-by-case basis. Mm. Yeah. What, you know, and what format that thing suits. And there is an aesthetic choice there about what format you're releasing on and the sorts of mastering you do on it, which is often missed in this kind of audiophile, almost like dehumanizing thing.
But it depends on, I mean, the talking earlier about these acetates, we've got the early B.B. King recordings, which were like one mic in a room. Actually, well mastered, what you do is you find the room. Because the one good thing about, not one good, but one of the good things about digital is you can really find the air in the room when you're mastering, and especially those old ambient recordings, you can totally transform them from you know, what we used to be able to do in terms of mastering.
So we've just got a final question here, and then we're going to have to wrap up. Final two, okay. If everyone's all right,
who's going first?
Okay.
Hi.
That's all right.
There's something that was just brought up there. It's about listening to something within the room, and it kind of crossed my mind is your guys who do archive labels, you're taking stuff from, especially stuff that's meant for soundtrack, is something that enhances a piece, say film or whatever. And how do you think of selling these things to audiences who may not necessarily have that kind of thing? They're seeing it as musical pieces alone rather than
I only release records that stand on their own. It's a film soundtrack, but it's a complete album. So it's got to work.
Yeah,
otherwise,
I'm probably not making myself that clear. I kind of see, you know, someone will probably have watched that film somewhere in the past, and the soundtrack to them is by the by. It might.
I wouldn't
contribute
release
to
it.
Their
you
joint.
Wouldn't release it.
I know Mike contributes to their enjoyment of the film. I was just saying, is you sell it now to those kind of people who might also like the archive aspect of it, who might like the soundtrack alone. But also, how do you see the marketing of the record to newer audiences who listen to music in a sort of background fashion?
I don't think they buy our records.
Yeah, they don't buy our records, and I don't actually. Most of my records, I don't really do any marketing, because they sort of go out to the same audience, a bit like yours, probably to the same sort of people over and over again who know it's there. I'm not trying to convert anyone into buying something that might not be very good in their mind. All I do is, I say it's a purely selfish thing from my part. I just put out records that I think are very interesting, and if they are a soundtrack that might, to some people's ears, be working for them as an audio experience, then we're not going to buy it, and I have no plans to convert them into my way of hearing. It's just, it is what it is, and people buy it because they like the label, I suppose, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the record, anything you release, has got to stand on its own. Yeah, it might be from a film, but it doesn't mean it's background music. You know, I've released like killer, crazy electro records.
Yeah, often the music's better than the film.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to do two of those in the next 2 months.
But one thing you mustn't do is like a soundtrack and then go and find the film if you haven't seen it, because it's probably going to be very disappointing.
So just a final question here, I think.
This was touched on question before last, and it's actually about mastering. A couple of weeks ago, I got this new remastered CD version of Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road album. And I played it, and I played the original album, which I borrowed off somebody a couple of days later, because the CD didn't sound like what my memory of the album was like. It had this sort of weird dead thuddy sound, mastered by this famous person called Bob Ludwig, or Bob Ludwig in America. So it kind of crushed my idea of what the Elton John album sounded like. So my question is, and then Johnny, it's actually in relation perhaps to your Kenny Graham album.
Oh, yeah.
Which one?
The Moondog Sweep.
Oh, yeah.
But generally to all of you, do you actually refer back to the original experience, the original record, the original buyer would have had to try and recreate that original sound? Or are you going for the most superfied, best mastered, best representation of what's on your master tape? And there's obviously a slippage between those two things. How do you do it on a case-by-case basis?
Which buyer are you referring to? Do two people have the same experience of a record?
So what is your baseline? What is your judgment? How do you make that call?
If the composer's alive,
tapes.
If he's happy, I'm happy.
Yeah.
Because he fucking made the record. Yeah. So if he says to me, that's great. And we've done it. I released Room 237, a tiny little documentary. Spent £3,000 getting the thing mastered because they were never happy with it and we couldn't get it right. And then eventually they were like, okay, that's cool. So it has to be like that they're happy. And if they're dead, then I suppose it's me. And I get a few friends that listen to it.
The way I always look at it, it's the tape speaks to you. What's in here? You know, I mean, if you're lucky, you got the master tape and you've managed to make a really good transfer off it. You know, sometimes you have to work with what you got. So basically, I've got engineers that have got a lot of experience. They're very sensitive to genre. So in other words, you know, they're not going to master a Northern Soul record with a load of bass on it and no top. You know, they'll be sympathetic. They know periods. They know what records sounded like at different times. They throw their hands up in despair if you hand them an 80s track because there's nothing you can do about it. It just sounds awful. And, you know, but they certainly know the 50s and 60s
That's
very well
era.
And 70s. You're putting that on track records.
Yeah, so I think it's on a case-by-case basis based on the material you have, and each record you put out is based on it, you know, sounds as good as you can make it, whether it comes from a tape, a cassette. I've got one of those coming up.
It's also based on all your individual, your body of knowledge. Like you all have this massive body of knowledge about what that should sound like, what was happening at the time, what other things sounded like, the story of that record, whether the person who originally mastered it was any good, and all those sorts of things come into play. So
All I will say is that since putting records out in 1995, I've had one complaint about the sound of a record, which I don't think is too bad. And that's not, you know, that's down to my, obviously, the person who remastered it, but people generally don't have complaints, really. Because we're brilliant.
I suppose, again, but it also goes back to what equipment people are listening to.
There's only so much control you can have
about
over
getting approval from your composers. They're now 75, 80. Where's the top end on their hearing? You know, they keep telling you, hey, this sounds really dull. Again, referring it externally to sort of people who produced them in the first place is especially with older material, to be honest, can be a dangerous path to go down.
If I get a call or a text off, like Joe D'Elia, who did Miss 45, which never came out, so it's not a reissue, it never came out, and he's like, oh my God, that's awesome, sounds so good, then that's all I don't care if we sell any. Because I've done what I wanted that record to listen to at home. Okay. I should probably just make test pressings for myself.
That'd be cheaper.
I could sell those.
Yeah.
At £200 each. I'd make more money. All right, I'm off.
Yep. So that seems a really good place to wrap it up. Thanks everyone for letting us run over a little bit, and thanks to our panelists.
Okay. Cheers, Jen, Spencer, Johnny, and Roger. That was a very good laugh.